This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Earlier this year, Reverend Barber announced an effort by faith and moral leaders to carry forward Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a poor people's campaign working across 25 states to alleviate the triad forces of poverty, militarism, and racism that Dr. King knew were poisoning our country then and still threaten us today.
The Reverend Dr. William Barber is pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and architect of the Forward Together moral movement that gained national acclaim with its Moral Monday protests, in which drew tens of thousands of North Carolinians and other moral witnesses to the state legislature. He has served as president of the North Carolina NAACP, the largest state conference in the South. His two most recent books include Forward Together and The Third Reconstruction.
And Dr. Barber is the founder and president of Repairers of the Breach, an organization that seeks to build a progressive agenda rooted in a moral framework to counter the ultra-conservative constructs that try to dominate the public sphere. Reverend Barber is one of the most influential progressive religious figures in the country, and he joins us right off the protest line in the fight for 15 and a union, and I bet you're tired.
Well, in some ways, and in some ways inspired, I'm glad to be with you. We had well over 5,000 poor and working poor people gathered. The workers' stories are tremendous. I was with Mary Kay Henry, who's the international president of SEIU, and others. One of our elders, Reverend Jackson, joined as well. But the workers today, intersectionality, fusion, coalition, black and white and brown, young and old and gay and straight together, saying that we have to deal with these issues of systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and we have to literally turn and transform our national morality and our national moral conversation in this country. And we just drove into Detroit to be here for 2 days of organizing with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, where I'm the co-chair with, along with Dr. Liz Theo Harris, who's the director of Kairos, the Kairos Center at Union Theological Seminary.
Reverend Barber, how do you begin to wean people from the false prophets who place, without going too biblical here, the golden calf of materialist wealth to prize above all else, and use the demagogy of scapegoating immigrants, black and brown people, the awful tools of xenophobia and white supremacy and white nationalism to enlist a following. It has stirred the hornet's nest, which runs deep in the bloodstream of the politics of this country, all those chauvinistic realities. How do you do that in your organizing?
Well, one of the things I've said, taking Donald Trump, people said, well, we've never seen this before. And I said, you may have never seen it, but it's been happening. And this is American as apple pie, using white rage and racism, xenophobia, and otherization to turn people against one another. That has been a part of the American construct. In fact, of the matter, let me just give a point to your audience. Most people are saying that these Civil War statues were raised right after the Civil War. That is not true. 80% of them were raised between 1898 and 1922. What was going on then? Plessy versus Ferguson, recodification of white supremacy, voter suppression, Jim Crow, lynching of black men, and an open racist in the White House in Woodrow Wilson, who played Birth of a Nation in the White House long before Bannon was ever there. The statue in Charlottesville was raised in 1917, the year after Wilson played Birth of a Nation in the Oval Office. You have to have fusion coalition. You have to have the kind of organizing that takes racism seriously and takes poverty seriously and brings those together as in a critique that allows you to talk, to bring black people to the table, and white people to the table, and brown people to the table. We have been able to organize in Appalachia, in the mountains of North Carolina, as well as in the Black Belt of eastern North Carolina, not by giving different messages, but having a message of integrity and not talking about left versus right, but right versus wrong, and talking about the deep moral values. And yes, we've had to go into the Bible, because you will not find a progressive achievement in this country that did not have some deep moral underpinning. And so we decided we were not going to allow people to hijack the scriptures anymore, hijack faith anymore, that we were going to challenge that. And because there are more than 2,000 scriptures in the Bible that deal with how you treat the poor, the least of these, the hurting, and those who have been done unjustly. And if you look in the Quran or in other texts, it's the same thing. So we took that very seriously and said we needed a moral movement, not a partisan movement, not a left movement, not a right movement, but a moral movement that tried to capture the moral center that reached deep down into our religious values. But also, if people weren't religious per se, we said, okay, let's look at the deep moral values of our Constitution, establishing justice, providing for the common good, promoting the general welfare, domestic tranquility. And what we found is in using this moral language and shifting the narrative and refusing to allow people to separate the discussion of systemic racism from systemic poverty, for instance, but holding them together, we were able to have honest conversation and bring people together. Now, we also found out you have to have agenda-driven civil disobedience to drive home how extremism is hurting people. You have to put a face on extremism, and you have to be dedicated over the long haul. We had over 14 straight weeks of civil disobedience in North Carolina. Over 1,000 people got arrested, more than any time in history. But they were black, they were white, they were young, they were old, they were gay, they were straight, they were brown, they were wealthy, they were poor. But they were came together in this deep moral fusion movement, and that in itself began to change the consciousness of the state. And then the next year, 100,000 people showed up following February after that summer of discontent and civil disobedience. And so I think, if you ask me, you organize with the fusion understanding that comes out of the fusion movements of the 1800s, right after the Civil War, when blacks and whites came together. You organize without using our deepest moral values. You organize with a commitment to civil disobedience. You organize saying that you will never separate the race issue from the class issue. You bring those things together. I believe that Americans, many, many of them, are ready for an honest conversation. They have been bamboozled. We have to show, particularly many whites, that when you allow people to lead you by saying, for instance, if you follow us, you know, the main things we're going to give you is we're going to be against women's rights to have an abortion, we're going to be against the homosexual, we're going to be for tax cuts. Look underneath that and see that the same people that give you that, they also vote against living wages. They vote against public education. They vote against things that would help the poor. And guess what? There are 8 million more poor white people than there are African Americans, and 5 million more poor white people than there are Latinos. So let's flip that over. If we can bring those same people together and understand their common reality, and then make it not about Republican versus Democrat, but about something much deeper, our deeper moral values and moral standards, we can build a movement in 21st century that I believe can turn back much of what we're seeing today. In fact, I believe it's a must.
And what would be the role of unions in this new movement? What have been the role of unions supporting your movement to date? And what should be the role of unions in this fusion movement and also the poor people's movement? Of course, they're one and the same thing.
Well, I was with poor workers and poor people, 515, and they all have committed to be a part of the poor people's campaign because they understand this intersectionality between, for instance, the fight for living wages, full employment, and union labor rights, the fight for educational equality for every child, public educational equality, the fight for criminal justice reform, the fight for health care for all and environmental justice, and the fight for equal protection under the law for everybody, regardless of your racial creed or your sexuality, and the fundamental fight for expanding voting rights, stopping voter suppression, and ultimately getting us to a place where we have a registration automatic at 18. If you can register automatic at 18 for the war, you ought to be registered at 18 to vote for people who can sing the war. And that all 6 or 7 of those things are interconnected. And one of the things that I've said when I go to union workers, I was at, for instance, the steel workers, and someone said, well, you can't talk about Trump because some of the union persons may have voted for him. And I said, we have to talk about it. And so what I said to them is, whatever made you think that you could trust a racist to be right on labor? You know, I told him a story. My grandma used to say, if you scratch a lie, you'll find a thief. You know, if someone promotes xenophobia and racism, then what then makes you think you can trust them on the issue of labor? And we're certainly finding out that right now. What unions have to understand today, they understood back in the day. The March on Washington was about civil rights and labor rights. It was about voting rights and jobs. And we can't make the mistake today that happened in 1967 when Dr. King listed militarism, materialism, and racism as the three evils. You know, that after he did the speech at Riverside, 150 newspapers wrote against him. Many unions left him. Civil rights organizations left him. Preachers left him. And in reality, 50 years later, we realized that was a mistake. So we can't make the mistake of the past. So unions and laborers are very much a part of this movement. We have 400 families in this country right now, according to Joseph Stiglitz's book, The Price of Inequality, that make an average of $97,000 an hour, while we are locking people up who simply want 15 and a union. We know that the suppression of voting actually hurts workers. Think about it. The worst thing we faced in this past election was not Russia, even though I do believe Russia hacked the system, but there were 868 fewer voting sites in the black and brown and poor communities. There was voter suppression. 250,000 votes were suppressed in Wisconsin. Trump wins by less than 40,000 votes. When you look at that, voter suppression is a labor rights issue, because if you have voter suppression, then you're going to elect extremists who more than likely will not support unions and voter rights and living wages. We have to begin to see the intersectionality and not see those as separate things, as though, i.e., voting suppression is voting issues are for black folk and other people, and then labor rights is for the union. No, no, no. They are all interconnected. With this DACA piece, when we see the president willing to pit young children against workers, we have to challenge that false narrative, because he's pitting the young Latino children against workers, but he's also willing to give more tax cuts to the corporations that will hurt workers. And he said during the campaign he thought the minimum wage was too high already. So the same people that are against the Latinos are against labor unions. The same people against labor unions are against public education. Same people against public education are many times against the LGBTQ community. Same people against the LGBT community are often against voting rights and for voter suppression. If they are sinister enough to be together in this systematic attack, then we must be smart enough, courageous enough to come together. And maybe in coming together, we can even transform many of the people who are now supporting the wrong structures and the wrong systems.
Well, perhaps I can press you a little further. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about as Ken asked the question about the significance and importance, which we both clearly believe, of unions in the struggle for peace and justice, is the reality, really, that organized labor has had a level of timidity, certainly timidity in confronting the Democrats and extracting many concessions from the Democratic Party in response to what they need for their membership. And there's also been an alienation or a detachment from the full needs and composition of a human being, of a worker.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been there on the front lines. I mean, we recently had but it was the coalition, the African American Coalition of Local 10 of the ILWU, who stood up against the patriotic prayer, white supremacist, white nationalist organization. But the unions haven't been there holistically grappling with the reality of race and class, of class and gender. And then there's the other thorny problem of, you want a movement that's humanist and that is peaceful in its intent, but we have people who are bound towards genocide and are being inflamed by a current administration through its Justice Department, through its Supreme Court, through its executive branch. So we wind up with some of the tensions that we had, the kind of Malcolm X, if you will, or seeming tensions between more militant approaches. I mean, how do we deal with these realities of the ferocity and cruelty of a system that would destroy people? How do you build that movement with that kind of poison that is rearing its head in what looks like a brown shirt movement in this country?
We can't isolate what's happening now as though it's just happening now, because then that disables us from learning from the past and learning lessons from the past of how we did overcome it. You know, the fusion movement in the 1800s was able to overcome much of the problems of their day. The social gospel movement was able to overcome. The civil rights movement, in many ways, was able to overcome the women's suffrage movement. And we have to look to those movements. Now, movements are messy, and people are hurting, and people are wounded, and people choose different realities. I believe that certainly at the tip of the leadership of the movement, it needs to be militantly nonviolent. You know, Dr. King talked about a marvelous stability where it's nonviolent, but it's not non-confrontational. And we learned this in North Carolina and are learning in other places. You know, there were people who just wanted us to protest in the street. We said, no, we're going to go into the legislative halls. And one of the things the Poor People's Campaign will be talking about over 40 days is people going and doing nonviolent civil disobedience in Ryan's office, in McConnell's office. To make sure people understand, you can't just focus on Trump or get rid of Trump and think we've solved all the problems. We're talking about going into 25 legislatures around the country simultaneously, putting a face on these issues, people engaging nonviolently at the same time based on an agenda, seeking to change the narrative. We're not going to change the narrative in this country unless we're willing to put our bodies on the line, because just doing tweets and emails and having nice meetings is not going to do it. And we have to be able to challenge both parties. Many do not know that the Tomorrow Monday movement and the Forward Together Tomorrow Monday movement started pushing Democrats. It didn't start when Republicans suddenly took over, or extremists who called themselves Republicans. We even had to push Democrats. I will tell you that we have to be very strong in that regard, too, because sometimes in issues like race and poverty, you know, Republicans don't want to talk about race. Democrats, when they talk about race, for instance, are often limited to issues like David Duke or some extreme white supremacy action, which is the wrong way to talk about systemic racism. Republicans want to talk about poverty, but they talk about poverty in the sense that the poor are somehow immoral and to blame for their own problems. Democrats talk about poverty and they don't even say the word. They say things like those working to get into the middle class. Well, some people are not working to get into the middle class. They are actually poor. They are just trying to survive day to day. We have to have a movement that, in a real sense, breaks through that and has what one theologian calls subversive hope. That's not just operating out of despair, but operating out of a kind of subversive hope that can be honest, like Dr. King did, about the nightmarish reality, but then still look toward a dream and be willing to do the things necessary to push forward to that dream. And a movement that has a long-term focus, and a movement that understands we can't just focus on Washington, D.C. We have to transform state capitals and state legislatures if we want to transform this country. I don't know if your listeners know, but the goal of the white Southern strategy was really to control 13 states. Because they knew if they controlled the 13 states in the South, from Virginia through over to Texas, they controlled 171 electoral votes and only needed 99 from the other 37 states to control the presidency. They controlled 30% of the United States Congress and 26 members of the United States Senate, which means they only needed 25 seats from the other 37 states. You look at that, that is a real cynical approach to leadership. And they said they would do it, according to Kevin Phillips, by fear and turning people over against one another and using false narratives about race and otherization. However, in those same states today, if you register 30% of the those and connect them with progressive whites and Latinos, it's a new day. The South is no longer solid. If you change the South, you change the nation. And so we have to have those kinds of strategies built into a movement. Now, the union piece that you asked me about, the union movement has always been interesting. You know, there was a period of time when blacks and whites were working together in unions in the late 1800s, and then race was used to split them away from each other, saying to white workers, do you want these black people to have the same thing as you? The Knights of Labor tried to come to the South, and race was the Achilles heel. During the turn of the century, many black people who had great skills were forced to train whites in how to do their jobs, and they were made the janitors, and they became, the blacks were made the janitors, and the whites became the millwrights. So we've had this struggle even within the union. That's why we have A. Philip Randolph and the Pullman Port of the Union. However, in the midst of all of that, there have been times when we've been able to come together. And I think the pain of this moment opens up an opportunity. But I agree with you that unions, for instance, must not just talk about the working class. They must use the language poor. They must engage in taking on systemic racism. They cannot be afraid to do that. We can't just, you know, accept a few negotiations here and there. The union movement must be, as it was in its roots, aggressive. And that's why I see so much hope in the fight for 15, because these young people and other people who are coming together in the health industries and in the fast food industry, they are building a fusion coalition. They recognize that it's 64 million of them who make less than a living wage, and 54% of all African Americans make less than a living wage. And I see them when I go to their rallies. They decided early on in the fight for 15 that they wouldn't separate the issue of race and the issue of labor and the issue of jobs and the issue of wages and the issues of the environment and the issues around voting rights. They said that early on in their organizing, and that's what we have to do. Early on, we must make these commitments in our organizing to say you will not separate us and we will not be forced into our individual silos, but we will build a common movement together. And I've said to some people, if we can't join together for 40 days next year, 40 days out of 365, that means 325 days the rest of the year, everybody can do what they want to. But if we can't find a way to organize, say, 1,000, 1,500 people in every state, 2,500, 3,000 in District of Columbia, of all of our organizations to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience around an agenda that deals with race and poverty and ecological devastation, the war economy, and our national morality. We can't do that for 40 days. Then the people who fight the issues that we care about do not have the problem. We have the problem. And I have a great hope that we are going to show America that we do know how to come together. And in this moment of intensity, we're going to intensify our unity and intensify our ability to act together. That is the only thing I know that can fight off genocide and even despair. It is to get involved in a movement and push back using our deepest values and our deepest moral understanding to push back against extremism. Frederick Douglass was asked this question. There's a story that said he was in despair after the Dred Scott decision.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just say this. People have faced things much worse than what we're facing. We have to own that, too. We cannot make Trump bigger than he is. We cannot make this moment bigger than it is. There are people that made it through lynching, made it through Jim Crow, made it through so much more. But Frederick Douglass was in despair. And the story is told that I think it was Harriet Tubman, saw him and hollered at him before he made a speech, "Is God dead?" He raised an ontological question with him. "Frederick, are you going to allow this Supreme Court decision to control you, or are you going to look to a higher source and a higher moral understanding and get up and fight?" Frederick, when he answered that question, got back up and continued to fight.
Now, is that historically documented, or are you just giving us a wonderful tale?
Well, there actually is some belief that is historically documented. It's been told down through the years, but I will tell you something that is historically documented and that I know definitely, and that's something that comes out of the scriptures. And it was in a time when the prophet Ezekiel said that the politicians had become like wolves who were devouring the poor, the immigrants, and the needy, and the children. And the preachers were giving cover for the politicians. And then the scriptures go on to say in the 37th chapter of Ezekiel that God showed Ezekiel a valley of dry bones. And he said, can these bones live? And Ezekiel said, I don't know. And God said, okay, I need you to go down in the valley, because that's a great army down there. Those are the broken people. Those are the people that have been oppressed by the political structures and oppressed by those who will not pay them right. Go down there and begin to talk to them and speak to them and organize them. And they came together and organized, and a mighty spirit pulled them together. And the scriptures say that they became a mighty army. That's one of the great texts in the Bible. But it required Ezekiel to go and speak to the bones. The people were like bones. I believe, and I've seen it, I remember the despair that was in North Carolina when the extremists took over our legislature through fraud and through voter suppression and through racial gerrymandering. And many people just wanted to go home. 17 of us went in one day to protest, got arrested. They arrested one woman in a wheelchair who had cerebral palsy. The next Monday, people came. The movement got ahead of us. We had to catch up. By the end of the summer, over 1,000 people. We found out this year, after the governor who led that was actually removed from office because the people voted him out of office, we found that after 14 weeks of our protest, there was a study done by the PP, the Public Policy Polling, that said the governor's number dropped to 39% to 4%, and he never recovered. And they went on to say it was because of a constant, committed, moral, willing to do civil disobedience, unified fusion movement that refused to give up, even when they kept voting against us. We continued to press on. We have to have that kind of consistency and persistence in this time in which we live today.
This has been part one of our interview with the Reverend William Barber. Tune in next week for part two, where the Reverend Barber talks further on creating a fusion movement to defeat Trump and move forward together to a just society.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.